Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Before we go any further, as you just heard in the news there, it's been confirmed that five young people on their way to a night out, like thousands of other young people all over the country last night, five young people died in a road accident in County Louth last night. John Mulligan is editor of the Argus newspaper and he's just stepped out of the Garda press conference. John, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
What can you tell us?
Brendan, unfortunately, five young people, as you've said, have lost their lives following a two-car collision in County Louth, just on the outskirts of Dundalk, shortly after 9 o'clock last night. Three males and two females tragically lost their lives, and a sixth person in that vehicle was taken to Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital in Drogheda, where they're described as having serious but non-life-threatening injuries. All six people were in a Volkswagen Golf, which collided with a Toyota Land Cruiser, and a male and a female from the Toyota Land Cruiser were also taken to Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital, where they are also receiving treatment for non-life-threatening injuries. Gardaí this morning, superintendent, described it as a very difficult scene for emergency services, the Louth Fire Brigade, THSE staff, ambulance crews, and indeed the staff in Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital. And he's appealed for witnesses, for anybody with dash cam footage or camera footage from the scene, from the Dundalk RD Road, the N52, and the local road, the L3168, between the hours of 8:30 last night and 9:15.
And John, I know news of this is just kind of percolating out this morning, but like, I mean, so many lives and families ruined, but I presume that the whole community and the whole county is in shock.
Absolutely, Brendan. I mean, unfortunately, road tragedies happen all too often. And today is the Day of Remembrance for road victims worldwide. And there will be a mass in Drogheda, as there is each and every year, to remember those victims. And that mass will take place in St. Augustine's Chapel in Drogheda at 1 o'clock today. And there will be a special appointment to that mass today, given the circumstances where people who have come from Carrickmacross, Drumcondra and County Meath, and indeed Scotland, who are believed to be where the five people have come from.
There certainly will be a poignancy there. John Mulligan, editor of the Argus newspaper, thank you very much. Okay, we'll have a look at the front pages of the papers. So, the Business Post, state readies nuclear option, that's in red, to ram through vital projects. The government is set to press the nuclear button and grant itself emergency powers to bypass the planning structure and fast-track key infrastructure projects. So a critical infrastructure bill will fast track a small number of highly strategic investment projects, and the emergency powers bill will be the nuclear option for projects of national importance, allowing them to bypass many parts of the planning process. The Sunday Times, they're leading with split homes into flats, minister to tell older voters. Ditching plans to incentivize older people to downsize, because we know they don't always react well to that. The top of the Sunday Times front page is about the forthcoming statutory inquiry into the treatment of children with scoliosis and spina bifida at Children's Health Ireland. And the headline is Harvey Morrison's death among six included in work of scoliosis inquiry. And John Mooney has an interesting piece inside. You will remember that it was the Sunday Times carried the story of a whistleblower last week who made a protected disclosure saying that Harvey Morrison was deemed to be palliative, i.e. not suitable for treatment. John Mooney is writing today that there are in fact two conflicting accounts now of what happened, and there is the whistleblower's account of Harvey being deemed palliative, and then there is one that is no better an explanation and no more comforting an explanation to anyone, which is that it was down to simple bureaucratic failure and people being moved on and off of lists, and then they should be put back on lists when they move a consultant, and that all those boxes weren't ticked. The Irish Mail on Sunday, they are leading with the whistleblower version of the story today, which is, now we should say, that is currently under investigation. So that is by no means gospel at the moment. But they have Gillian Sherratt, Harvey's mother, responding to the headline being CHI medic dismissed Harvey as not fit for a sneeze. And Gillian Sherratt said to read that was a gut punch. She is in the Sunday Times as well, and she is making the point, these parents are extraordinary people and what they're achieving is extraordinary. She's making the point that she does not want this inquiry called after Harvey, that it's not just about Harvey, it's about all these children. And indeed, Stephen Morrison whispered into Harvey's ear, into his son's ear when he was dying, that he would dedicate his life to him and to getting answers on it. The one timeline we are sure of is that Harvey's spine curved and curved and curved until it crushed its organs beyond the point where they could recover. And when he did get the surgery, it was too late. And the one timeline we are sure of as well is that his parents watched this happen to their son in slow motion without being told anything about what was going on, really, about him being taken off that list. OK, the Sunday Independent, another tragic story. Tuzla failures led to death of four-year-old, family claims. So the family of a four-year-old boy who was murdered by his stepmother believes systemic Tuzla failures, poor vetting and bad care decisions contributed to his suffering and death. You will recall that last week his stepmother, aged in her 30s, pleaded guilty on the fourth day of her trial to the child's murder, and she is due to receive the mandatory life sentence on December 1st. The Sun on Sunday is leading with murdered Owen O'Connell's brother says justice has prevailed after Ruth Lawrence was found guilty of his killing this week. The Sunday World leads with that Jerry Hutch is being hit with an €800,000 demand for unpaid taxes by cab. And the Mirror is leading with, we're on our way. Fans convinced good times are back and World Cup beckons. Portuguese Football Federation appealing for Ronaldo clemency. OK, our panel this morning, Oisín Coughlin is a public policy advisor. Tabitha Monaghan is a political reporter at the Irish Independent. Suzanne Rogers is with Social Justice Ireland. And Sean O'Neill MacPartlin is Director of Housing Policy at Progress Ireland. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Would we start, Tabitha, tell me about the front of the Business Post and the nuclear option.
Yeah, so I think because we're focused so much on this housing plan this week, the other side of this is the delivery of infrastructure and how crucial it is to get that going. So essentially, as you said, the government is looking at these nuclear options, essentially bringing in emergency legislation to bypass the planning process, to be able to ram through key projects to be able to get infrastructure going and by default get housing going. And we're hearing quite a lot about, you know, the 300,000 houses that they want to deliver by 2030, but then we hear other projects, including the Greater Dublin Drainage Project, which is at the moment caught up in a judicial review. And we've heard from Ishga Éireann, for example, they were in an Oireachtas committee, I think, last week, and said something like that is a key piece of legislation which was first mooted in 2004. And if we are going to try and get to our housing targets of 50, 60,000 homes a year, that kind of project cannot be held up anymore. We need those projects to be able to go through. I think it'll take at least 3 or 4 years for a project. Let's say if that's greenlit tomorrow, it'll take 3 or 4 years for that to be delivered in the first place. So what the government is looking at is trying to get those key projects and those key pieces of infrastructure accelerated through the system so that we can get on with delivering homes and other infrastructure.
Oisín? Are you in favour of the nuclear option? You strike me as a guy who likes an old judicial review.
In my own organisation, Friends of the Earth, we didn't go down that road. We were more interested in Parliament and legislation. But judicial reviews, are like the courts, have a very, very important role in establishing whether something is legal or not, or has been done according to the law. And there's a lot of spin going on here. And in reading, for preparing for this show, there's a lot of academics and indeed, yes, some environmentalists who are saying, this is spin. It's not what it, like, we're being misled by, but this is not what's causing the delays. So, for example, first of all, on the numbers, only 1 in 20 on board Panola, now Commissioning Panola decisions last year went to court for judicial review. So it's not the main thing that's happening.
These are things that have been through a planning process, though, which is there for
yes,
a reason.
Yes, but
are the courts running the country?
Well, I don't know. What the courts do is decide whether something has been done according to the law. And of course, what they find often enough is that it hasn't been. As in, a mistake was made. And I've listened and read.
People would have a perception, Oisin, as you know, that on small things like, you know, the process not being followed through correctly to the letter, somebody brings a judicial review and it goes back to square one again.
Yes, and you could. But first of all, that's according to those who are more involved in this than I am. That's very rarely what happens. As in, it isn't the case that you win judicial reviews based on small procedural errors. They're more likely to be much more significant, or indeed to have been one of the reasons why planning applications from developers get turned down is because they have not been in accordance with the county development plan. So, or the Commissioning Panola has not reflected that. So, and it's as often as not developers who take against other developers who take judicial reviews.
Yeah, but eight wind farms and environmental energy, green energy projects were held up by judicial review last year. How do you feel about that?
Well,
then?
It has to be a level playing field, and environmental projects that I would like to see go through also have to respect the process. But I do think there's a question here that JRs are not the main issue. First of all, if we need to resource the courts properly, and Commissioner Panola
are
saying...
They seem to be a big issue. They've held up a water plan for Dublin for how long now? A badly needed water plan.
But it isn't
Dublin.
Only because of... Because you're saying it as if only we hadn't appealed it, but sometimes it's because a big mistake has been made that would make the outcome bad.
One individual, am I right?
In
Bord
Panola,
that?
I'm not sure if it's one individual in that case. I do know that in one case, in Bord Panola then, Eishgerin left it go for 4 years. They didn't pursue it. But I think one of the issues that I read in the articles about this today was actually if they involved stakeholders and individuals and locals in the pre-planning process more before it's all committed to paper, it would make a lot of sense. They do that with the developers, but not with they don't do the pre-planning process with the stakeholders. And therefore, it's only when that's all been committed to paper that everyone else has a chance to make their observations or ultimately to go to court. But it isn't the JRs that are holding it back as much as poor planning. If we had, the chair of the Bar Council said, the issue is if we had better planning decisions in the first place by government and better policy clarity, then we wouldn't be having negative court decisions.
It looks from this as if the government is going to take a hand.
But that's saying, no, we don't want you to bring this to court.
Is it time to push the nuclear option and get all these naysayers and blockers out of the way?
I mean, I'm a fan of regulation. I like to know that things are well built, that I am safe within the houses that are built, that it's not 40 stories when it should only be 3, all of those types of things. The thing about the plan we thought was very interesting was that refocus back on local authorities as a housing authority. So it is, again, I think, you know, planning is just a tiny, tiny, tiny part of all of this. And I do think, again, I wonder how much of that is smoke and mirrors to blame planning and to blame the one or two construction projects that are being held up as opposed to the amount of construction projects that are out there. I mean, even
and
around
people
here...
people do make the point that there are, 44,000 houses in Dublin with planning permission that aren't proceeding at the moment.
I saw a total of 90,000 nationally. 35,000 just between the two biggest developers, but nationally a total of 90,000 sites with permission that aren't going ahead.
Okay. Sean O'Neill MacPartlin, so you are Director of Housing at the Progress Institute. Do you want to just explain to people what the Progress Institute is first? Because people will have an idea that it is basically a billionaire's think tank.
Absolutely. So Progress Ireland was started we launched publicly in last year. A think tank is kind of common in Britain and the US, but kind of an unfamiliar entity here in Ireland.
So I think we have a lot of left-wing think tanks?
Well,
I wouldn't say a lot.
Yes, indeed. So we started it because we saw, you know, Ireland had all these problems. We can't build enough houses. We can't build enough infrastructure. I think we all agree we can't do those things very well. And we saw the bottleneck as ideas, as worked out policy ideas, mainly from other places, and kind of injecting those into the system, making the argument for them in detail.
And did the Collisons set up Progress Ireland or come on board with Progress Ireland?
So, yeah, we're associated with the Collisons. So they're sometimes cited as the founders. That's not true. Me and my colleagues, four other people, started Progress Ireland on our own. And we went to all of our funders, all of which are listed on our website for anyone to see. And we went to them with the pitch of, we think Ireland could do with more detailed policy ideas, specifically on housing and infrastructure and on technological innovation. And we thought as a kind of constructive voice would be good, that's not kind of polemically criticizing people, but rather putting forward ideas.
Are you left wing, right wing? Where do you see yourselves?
I think a lot of the left, I mean, you can leave it to other people to call us what they want, but I think a lot of the traditional left-right divides kind of obscures some important things. So, for instance, we think the state needs to have greater capabilities. I think that's a traditionally left-wing idea, that the state needs to be more effective at delivering what it wants to deliver, infrastructure, for instance. But we also, you know, we'll see in this conversation now, we think regulation is a problem around the world, not in general. We're not anti-regulation as such. But over-regulation has kind of slowed down building in the physical world. I think that's something we think is true. That might be more associated with the right. But like I said, I don't think those boundaries kind
okay.
of represent
so,
as well.
So taking all that then, what do you think of the housing plan?
So overall, you know, I think it's addressing, it's asking the right questions. So for instance, there's a big focus on getting the cost of construction down. I think the cost of construction is far too high. I think it's one of the main drivers of our problem. I think since 1971...
Why is it too high?
Well, there it's kind of... If you ask the Department of Housing, they will cite kind of interest rates. They will cite Ukraine. But since 1971, construction costs are up nominally about 45 times to build a house. That's much, much higher than the rate of inflation. It's much, much higher than the rate of inflation in construction materials and construction labor. So the question is, why is that gap emerging?
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons is, like, houses built now are nicer in a bunch of ways I think everyone wants. So
are they too nice?
Well, you know, a big chunk of it is things that are not too nice, like functioning water systems and so on and central heating. That's all good. That wasn't there in the early 70s and late 60s. But there's a lot of things that I think are gold-plated. The government has tried to dial back some of them. So balconies are now kind of optional under the new apartment regulations, if they get through their judicial review, which they're currently undergoing. The size on studio apartments are coming down to more conform with European standards before they are much too high. Dual aspect, which is like the light has to come from two kind of angles in the apartment. Now that's optional in a greater proportion of units. So I think all of this
okay,
is positive.
Okay, so people will say smaller, darker, the word shoebox comes up for people then.
Yeah, I know people like to say these sort of things, but like the fact is to build an apartment in Ireland is much, much too expensive. And like no matter how many apartments we build, if the cost of delivering an apartment is greater than what normal people can afford to pay for it, no amount of supply will get the price to come under that, under the cost, because people would lose money and they won't build it, right? So we have to get the cost down. The government are using regulation as one tool to get the cost down. They're also using tax as one other mechanism to get the cost down. So the VAT has come down to
9%. AKA tax breaks for developers, which is another...
You could equally say tax breaks for first-time buyers and renters, right? So if the cost of apartments are too high, ultimately the people who pay for that is people who want to buy apartments and people who want to rent them. So there's a like people say, oh, all the apartments are going to the big institutional landlords, no one can buy them, but nobody can afford them. That's quite the problem. It's not that they've been snatched up by kind of mysterious forces. Apartments that cost 500 grand to build are going to sell for much more than 500 grand. And people don't want to pay that for an apartment. So the cost has to come down, and this plan attempts to bring it down, and I welcome that.
And you think it might be successful? And like I know you were saying earlier about injecting ideas into the system. There is a view now that we've had enough ideas and it's time to actually put some of them into effect, and that's what this plan, if this plan does that, maybe it helps.
Yeah, absolutely. Like one, when reading the plan, I think everyone was a little bit bored because we've heard all this stuff before. I think that's probably a good thing because the government's now going to focus on doing these things. Whether they can do it and whether they will is kind of a different
question. Oisín, what do you make of all that?
I would love if it was true. I mean, I think I'm all in favour of think tanks and for a variety of perspectives to be represented in think tanks. And you know, good luck for having found funding and got on with it. I think one key thing that's missing in your description of what's causing the costs is land. So from what I understand, it's the value, a lot of this is coming from land speculation and land values. So for example, you know, a developer, as happened since the Bacon Report in the 1970s, the developers buy agricultural land, wait for it to be rezoned, then sit on that wealth for the best moment to do something with it. There was an article by Brian Carey in the business section of the Sunday Times, page 3, saying this is a greatest hits plan, not a concept album, but also saying the chances of a third big publicly quoted construction company are very low because they won't be able to get in and buy land cheaply like the other two have. So like land is at the heart of this, and I don't think this new government plan addresses that because it's still very much market-driven.
It's given billions more to the Land Development Agency and they are going to look at freeing up more state land for housing, aren't they?
Yes, but it's not clear we need to be rezoning more land as it is at the moment. I've heard Luck and Sir, for example, the housing experts say that there's quite a lot of rezoned land right now. It's who's owning it and what they're doing with it. So like the way we do it often ended up now is that like we a developer buys land, the local council rezones it, the developer builds houses, and then the county council buys at market value some of the final houses for social housing or whatever. Whereas they could be, and I've heard architects and others and planners say this, they could be buying the land themselves at agricultural value, rezoning it themselves, doing a master plan, putting in the infrastructure, and then contracting building companies to build some of it, or selling off plots.
That would be an awful lot cheaper. I did see the Taoiseach make the point, though, that the state is, as stands, the biggest property developer in the country still. Tabitha, in terms of using land, so splitting homes into flats as suggested by Minister James Brown in the Sunday Times seems to make sense, does it?
It does, but it seems to be a little bit, it's a move away from the idea of downsizing or the rebranded right-sizing because it was so politically unpalatable when any of those suggestions were brought forward. You know, it was very controversial. I think, yeah, it does make sense if it's being done in the UK. I think that's what James Brown is referencing now, seeing that being done, you know, giving older people the choice to stay in their home, but if they do feel that it's that their home is too big, that they can split it into two and it can become a flat. There are also other bits in the housing plan in relation to the certain exemptions like attic conversions or granny flats or the modular homes, the extensions, for example, on the back of houses that are going to be that can be bigger now as a result. It is one of those things, but I think we're talking about the use of land, we're talking about, you know, the splitting of homes. There are all these little small bits, and I know it's been spoken about quite a lot this week, the idea that there's no annual targets anymore. And I think like people listening in today are saying, well, what is in it for me? How am I going to be able to measure the success of this? I'm back in the box room of my parents' home, I'm saving for a deposit, and now I won't be able to measure the success of this housing plan because I won't, let's say next year, this year for example, where we don't expect that the government are going to meet the housing targets, there won't be housing targets in the years to come. And essentially what the government is saying, and I think it's quite a tall ask, is just bear with us. And it's actually what James Brown said earlier in the week. You know, he was asked, for those people who are looking to buy a home, what is your message to them? And he said, well, just hang in there. I think a lot of people have done that already. Yeah. They've been doing it for years.
Of all the things, the annual targets aren't going to get them off the hook because like it's 5 years, it's 30,000, 300,000 over 5 years, that's 60,000 a year.
They're still targets.
And all of the opposition politicians and all of the journalists will point out to them whether they managed to get 60,000 or not. And as we get closer to the election, it'll be, you've only got 150,000 out of 300,000. They won't get away with having no annual targets.
Suzanne, back to the idea of using the stock that we have more efficiently. Like when you talk about that thing about turning, like there's a lot of big old houses out. If you go out the coast, out the south of Dublin there, there's big 2-3 storey kind of period houses that were built for, I think, the officer class back in the colonial times. There's a thing in England called, we don't have it so much here, a garden flat, which is a very desirable thing, which is that often the basement of those houses is turned into a flat. It kind of makes sense. But you also were looking at the dereliction, I would go so far as making it a criminal offence, James Brown is saying in the Business Post. And again, like people like Conor Skean go on about this, if we use the stock that was there better.
That's it. I mean, it is that thing of like just building, as you said, building more and more and more units. Like there's certain parts of Dublin where there are apartments going up at such a rate, it's incredible to think how have we got a housing crisis and yet there's apartment block after apartment block after apartment block being built. So it does have to be about the stock we have. Is it affordable? Like this is a really, really interesting piece about dereliction. And again, I'm always struck by on Cunningham Road in Dublin, as you go up towards the Dublin Regional Homeless Executive, you pass a massive derelict stretch there. So that must be a real kick as you go in there. We have, like again, we're still a country that isn't at full population. Like they talk in this plan as well about meeting our population growth targets as we move forward. Like there are plenty of houses there. How do you incentivize somebody who owns a piece of property that they can actually afford to turn the key in and walk away from and never go back to? I find that quite extraordinary.
You know, yeah, well, no, they are going to be penalised from 2027 with 7% annual
why
taxes,
2027?
At least we're told.
You know,
apparently it takes time to figure out the register.
All
and the other
of
side
stuff.
Of it is that there will now be 140,000, I think, available in grants to bring back a derelict property. Another aspect of that, Sean, is the whole Chaumers thing, which was quite divisive. But then when there were opinion polls done on it, a lot of people agreed with it. Can I ask you a question? I'm just being nosy here. Mm-hmm. Did you punt the Chaumers thing first? And did you lobby the government on that or suggest that idea into the government? Because this is one of your big ideas, isn't it?
Well, like, first, I'll take issue with the divisiveness comment. Like, I heard someone in the government once
in the
say
discourse
that
it was divisive.
Yeah, in the papers
among
it was.
The chattering
classes. As you rightly pointed out, all of the polls showed overwhelming support. I've never seen a planning policy get such a level of support. We don't really poll very often in the papers on these things, but the vast majority of people supported this idea when you talked to
normal
people.
And did it originate with the Progress Institute?
So we didn't, you mentioned other countries, we didn't create the idea of building things in your garden.
I know, but did Progress Ireland inject that idea into the conversation here with the government?
Yeah, we were quite
open. Is that where it came from?
We were quite open about, we were writing in the press about it. I believe I wrote in the Irish Times, I think. I was on the radio a few times. We did meet the government about this. You can read about it online. I think there is an article by way of innuendo, kind of suggesting we said something weird.
But I'm not having any innuendo about it. Who did you meet and what kind of reception did you get?
I mean, we kind of put forward a bunch of ideas. One of these was the one we wrote most about, which was the granny flats. Just said, look, people want to do this. The garden space is there.
Was this to the last housing minister? Dara O'Brien?
No, I didn't meet Dara O'Brien about this. This was with like government advisors. And
okay.
Thankfully, all of this is publicly available on the lobbying register and people can...
Yeah, I'm not accusing you of anything.
No,
I'm curious
not.
As to that. It's interesting that you managed to get this idea in there and it actually came to fruition.
So I think previous governments, I looked into this, like I think Shane Ross, and apologies to Shane Ross if I'm misremembering, you know, in a previous government, this idea was floated. In various county council chambers, this idea gets floated fairly regularly. I think it was just a confluence of the kind of extremity of the situation with housing. People were kind of quite angry. The new government was looking for ideas. And I think they realized, as some of the articles today pointed out, that they have to succeed on this and they're willing to pull all levers this time. And I think this was one of the levers that happened to be on the table. And we were very happy to...
Oisín, just before we leave this, I want to get on to politics with Tabitha, but... That idea is just one example of, there are a lot of undensely populated suburbs around the place and people have a fine old quality of light and life and everything there, and they're not inclined to want things to happen in between their big gardens and in various spaces that are in there. Do we need to actually densify up all the suburbs around the city and people be willing to, like, no longer have that kind of suburban landscape they're used to?
I mean, I think yes, to a degree, is the answer. Obviously, without losing open spaces, and one of the problems with some of the deregulation that we've talked about is that you might end up with new bills that don't have, and we know this doesn't work from long decades of what's happened in our suburbs, outer suburbs at times. If you don't have the amenities, it's a social time bomb. But in the inner suburbs, where you have all of that to a high degree at the moment, there is space, and it is happening. You do see it happening a bit.
You can see apartment blocks popping up in all kinds of corner sites and here and
exactly.
there.
And I think that makes sense.
Infill, and it fits in with the local community and doesn't seem to have a huge impact in a way. Like.
And I think whether people who no longer need all of their house want to downsize, or whether they want to have a granny flat, I think all of those options should be open to people. I think, you know what, I think two things happen. One is the older people resist the idea that they're being forced to do something. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger people who are trying to find somewhere to live that they can depend on for a long time don't like the idea of these sort of short term. It looks like they're being fobbed off with that. You'll never have a proper house, but we'll give you this. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you're the government, you're
happy to live in the shed.
You know, you're going for the box room to the shed. Whereas, in fact, if you're the government, you're trying to say, "I want to do something right now while we do other things as well." So, I wouldn't be against.
Before we leave it, Sean, do you have a house?
No. Well, do I own a house? No, I don't. I've been renting. And interestingly, I've lived in I've run the gauntlet of government policy. I've lived in the co-living, what would they call
the Musselline co-living.
The Musselline.
How was that?
It was wonderful. Though it was empty.
Was it expensive though?
It was very expensive. I didn't last very long, precisely because of the cost. But it was nice living in the city, walkable to everywhere. It's not for everyone. I know it's banned now, so it's a legal sort of thing if it were to be built now. But, you know, when I left that, I moved back into my mother's in Port Leash. It's not particularly a sob story. I was very lucky to live with my mother. But commuting from Port Leash is much more unpleasant, at least for me, than walking from my shoebox, if you like. Very nice shoebox, A-rated one.
Yeah. Suzanne?
Just to pick up on that, I mean, the piece in The Independent about housing failures put social contract in peril, that's exactly it. You went to school, you went to college, you got your degree, you probably have a master's, I don't know whether you have a PhD, you have a good job. And as you said, that's still not enough. So somebody who's earning, there's another piece in here, a girl talking about she earns 30,000 a year, she's managed to get savings of 28,000, she can buy somewhere for 150. There's nowhere you can buy, even a derelict, you couldn't stand in the corner there for 150 grand a year, do you know what I mean? So it is exactly that. If we're looking at social cohesion, if we're looking at I've played by the rules, I should be able to put a secure, affordable roof over my head. I don't even need to buy it. I just need to be secure. But I do think, Ushi, I think some of the decisions that we're going to have to make are going to be unpopular, I think, to pick up on your point.
Okay. That's true for a lot of policies.
Okay, Tabitha. Politics still goes on. So the Mail on Sunday have FF insiders hinting at Micheál Martin's exit plan. And meanwhile, the Sunday Independent has a declaration.
Yeah. So James Lawless, Higher Education Minister, he did an interview with Conal Thomas for the Sunday Independent. And he has said that he has ambitions to be Fianna Fáil leader and the Taoiseach, but just not yet. So I think he is the second since the budget, and I could be wrong, but I think it's the second after Jim O'Callaghan, to also express interest in being the Fianna Fáil leader. And it just comes at a time where we know Micheál Martin is still under considerable pressure from his backbenches, from the rebels, in relation to the handling of the presidential campaign. So I think it's interesting that we have James Lawless coming out and saying, well, look, I'm interested in doing it, but not just yet. And I think he also says, you know, Micheál Martin, he'll know when the time is right to step down, and that nobody can go on forever.
And on that time is right, what are John Drennan and Valerie Hanley saying in the Mail on Sunday about the exit strategy?
Yeah, so I think what it seems to be reporting in the Mail is that the timeline for Micheál Martin has kind of come back a little bit. Initially, what people thought when this started happening, and we had that monumental Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party meeting that went on for hours and hours, and people were really angry, upset after Jim Gavin withdrew from the campaign, that potentially Micheál Martin would be able to see out his leadership to the end of 2027, and that's going to be when the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste switch over.
Right.
And that would be kind of the natural time for Micheál Martin to step back as leader of Fianna Fáil. Now what the Mail are reporting is that Micheál Martin, actually it could be the end of 2026, and that is when Ireland finishes with the EU presidency, and that could be the moment when Micheál Martin, you know, decides that that is his moment.
And then they get to blood James Lawless as a Taoiseach for a year before. Okay. All right, our panel staying with us, Oisín Coughlan, Tabitha Monaghan, Suzanne Rogers and Sean O'Neill MacPartlin. We'll take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Oisín Coughlan, Tabitha Monaghan, Suzanne Rogers and Sean O'Neill McPartlin. But as you will be aware, another World Cup qualifier coming up this afternoon with Ireland taking on Hungary at 2 p.m. And I'm joined now by the Puskás Arena, from the Puskás Arena in Budapest, by RTE's football correspondent Tony O'Donoghue. Good morning, Tony.
Hi, Brendan.
Tony, we've lost the run of ourselves now, obviously, after Portugal. So a victory today would secure a spot in the playoffs. Can a nation dare to dream, Tony?
We can, actually, yeah. A bright, sunny day here at the Puskás Arena. It was freezing and dull and grey yesterday. Temperature much warmer today. It's 2 hours, 20 minutes and 9 seconds to kick off, according to the stadium clock here. And Ireland come into this game knowing a win will get us through to a playoff for the World Cup in North America. Now, if you told me that after the defeat to Armenia in September, that we'd have something to play for in the last game of the group, I simply wouldn't have believed you. We were well beaten in Yerevan. People will remember that. And even in the match before that, against today's opponents, Hungary, Ireland were poor, and it wasn't until Hungary had a player sent off that Ireland battled back to draw that game. In fact, for the three home games we had, each of our opponents had a player sent off: Hungary, Armenia, and the Independent Republic of Cristiano Ronaldo, which was great fun. So our luck was in. The tide has turned, you might say. We played better in Lisbon, and then we fell to a narrow defeat there, but we beat Armenia at home and then last Thursday, and it was a miracle, really. The miracle of Lansdowne Road, we're calling it, because Heimir Hallgrímsson's men, they pulled a performance out of the bag that I wasn't expecting. I don't think anybody was, to be fair, and they deservedly won the game 2-0. I mean, I remember Shane Long's goal against Germany 10 years ago, and that was a moment. And I think we loved it. But the atmosphere in the Aviva last Thursday night, the fact that we won it 2-0, could have been more. And the whole Ronaldo circus, it was brilliant. And that brought hope back to Irish football that we can deliver on the big day. So today is it. The fans have travelled in their thousands. And I'd say the mood would be giddy optimism, actually. I met a man coming down in the lift this morning in the hotel. He was wearing an Ireland shirt. And he told me he's a six-week-old baby at home. But after Thursday night, his wife gave him her blessing for this trip. So fair play to him. And more especially,
we're back to the days of the credit union being called into play. Again, Tony,
we could well be. It's a beautiful arena, by the way. It's going to host the Champions League this year. Over 67,000 people are going to be here. Over 3,000 Irish, we hear. Hungary have a genuine star in Liverpool's Dominik Szoboszlai. But from a Hungarian point of view, they only need a draw. And I wonder, and I'm kind of hoping, that might lead to a bit of mixed messaging from them. Like, if the game is tight, let's say, and scoreless with 10 minutes to go, okay, do they stick or do they twist? So, look, Irish football has been in a bad state for years now. Last time we reached the World Cup was, some people call it Saipan, in 2002. It was actually Japan and Korea. But if Ireland play with discipline and keep their heads in what's going to be an amazing atmosphere, and Troy Parrott does it like he did on Thursday, yes, Brendan, we have a chance.
Tony O'Donoghue, thank you so much. And coverage of Ireland v Hungary starts at 1 p.m. on RTE2 today and on the RTE player. The match will also be carried live here on RTE Radio 1 at 2 o'clock, and there will be a live vlog on the RTE News app and on RTE.ie /sport. So Sean O'Neill McPartlin, your research on behalf of the Progress Ireland brought you
progress
to Lansdowne Road on Thursday night. Now, don't panic, I'm not looking for expert analysis, but it looked like an extraordinary atmosphere there.
It was. I was there with my two nephews. I was sort of roped in last minute and given a free ticket. I was very lucky. I haven't watched football in about 10 years.
So like everyone, yeah.
So it was kind of like out of the loop a little bit. So I vaguely remember Portugal being a very good team. I turned to my 10-year-old nephew and I said, well, this is going to be bad, right? Like, we're just here for the fireworks and we're here for the atmosphere. And he looked at me and goes, no, we're going to win. And, you know, Tony in the report there mentioned the atmosphere. The atmosphere was just incredible. I'm sure the team kind of picked up on the belief in the crowd from everyone, from my 10-year-old nephew, who was just utterly convinced we were going to thrash them. Yeah. And then everyone on the side, the stands opposite, everyone seemed convinced, and I was convinced too. And it looks like the team was convinced too.
It just shows what conviction can do, doesn't it? Amazing, yeah. Oisín, COP is entering into the business end now. And again, this is back to how convinced are we all. Colin Murphy in the Sunday Independent is convinced, because we can all like get caught up in the detail of everything, but the broader picture is this is happening. Decarbonisation is happening, isn't it?
Yes, I think there's at least two things that are kind of almost at odds here. We have the technology on the one side and then the politics on the other. And the technology is giving us good news. Like renewables are now the cheapest form of electricity in the world. I think I saw that solar is like the cheapest form of electricity in 90% of circumstances now. It's not necessarily deployed everywhere yet, but it just the costs have plummeted, partly thanks to Chinese investment in solar panels and in renewables. So, it's going to provide 30% of total electricity by 2030. Some countries like Uruguay are already at 98%. Denmark's at 60%. So like we have the technology, but of course it is a disruptive change. Politicians are wary of it because they feel it's unpopular among some people, not the renewables, but the overall change. And of course, we have a very, very vested interest in the form of the most powerful, rich companies we've ever had before the tech companies, which is the fossil fuel companies, who don't want this to happen. And actually, there's an interesting part in Colin Murphy's article.
They're losing, are they?
Well, they're losing the economics of it. They haven't yet quite lost the politics of it, as we've seen from everywhere from the US to various parts of the world right now.
But is the argument now that like if the US doesn't want to come along with everyone else on this, fine. China is leading it, possibly not through great conviction, but through the fact that they like to get very good at making certain technologies.
And where the
they
money
are,
is.
Their carbon, yes, has plateaued as well, I believe.
And one of the reasons why, I mean, it isn't quite as simple as do you want to be like the US or do you want to be like China? But one of the reasons it is a bit like that is because, of course, the US has lots of fossil fuels that it thinks still it can make money from, or those companies do, although renewables are also can do very well and are very cheap there. China doesn't have as much fossil fuels, so it's much easier for it, you know, to invest in renewables and have its own energy, as is the case for a country like Ireland, than to have to import it. And you know, they're getting to I'm hearing now that they're piloting technology where you can charge your electric car in 7 minutes. So just about time to buy your coffee, like not the 45 minutes mm-hmm. it takes now. So the technology will win, but the politics are still pretty difficult. And actually, there's another piece in Colin Murphy's article that Sinead Walsh, who was the Irish government's climate ambassador until this year, she worked for the Department of Foreign Affairs, says actually the backlash is a sign that we're making progress, because it's kind of like, you know, the cornered animal that the fossil fuel.
You didn't want to say
are.
Rat, no?
Well, I couldn't remember the word. No, thank you. The rat is lashing out because it feels okay. its future is at stake.
So the last sting of the dying
wasp.
Yes,
thank you. That's what I'm trying to. Yeah, thank you for giving me more of my metaphors this morning, Brendan.
Suzanne. Of course, we've been waiting for, I'd say, 20 years now, at least, to become the Saudi of wind, which was going to be our place in this new world order. You picked a piece in the Mail on Sunday, Wind Farm Delays at Odds with Martin's COP Lecture.
Again, I suppose it's picking up on that point that we are going to have to make a move away from fossil fuels into renewables. Anybody who has spent any time on the west coast of Ireland, my family come originally from the islands off the west coast of Ireland, wind is what we have in plenty. And maybe it ties into the planning thing as well. But I suppose, I mean, this particular piece, I suppose, is leathering into the hypocrisy, I suppose, of standing up and saying, look, you know, the world needs to get its act together, and yet we don't seem to be able to move these projects forward. But I suppose to pick up on that transition piece, transitioning needs to be, we need to see a gain. So something needs, I need to have a win here. So if you say to me, these wind farms are going to go in and your electricity costs are going to hit the floor, we would all buy into that. There's no doubt in my mind about that. But again, you can see where is it the climate inequality report recently, they were saying that like the top 10%, they're always blamed for their emissions, but it's actually the wealth that they hold. So it's in stocks and shares and all of that. That's where a lot of their wealth is linked with emissions. So we're going to have to make that shift across. But I mean, we are like how we should be generating all of our. OK, we might not get the sun, but by God, we get the wind. But again, I think we would get buy-in if, as you said, every single house in the country sure. could get cut-rate electricity, charging your car in 7 minutes, we would be all in favour of
just
that.
Just because we actually get it, it's not so much sun you need, it's daylight. And obviously, as a northern country, we get lots of daylight, particularly in summer. So we actually have a lot of potential. Like it's up there with parts of Spain in terms of what we can get from solar. And the technology has improved so much that the solar is a runner here as
Sean,
well.
Sean, does Progress Ireland have, are you looking at climate change and transition and all that kind of thing much?
Not directly, but I should say, and Suzanne kind of pointed at this, is like the big, you mentioned the politics, Oisin. I think the big political constraint here is energy prices. Like households will not accept their energy prices going up, and they have been going up, and Ireland has some of the highest before tax household energy prices. I mean, the highest in Europe, and our kind of non-household energy prices are really high too.
That alternative energy is going to bring that down either right now, are they?
I think there are some problems with a grid that's 100%, you know, wind, for instance. Not that anyone here is saying it should be 100% wind. You know, there are problems with things like intermittency and curtailment and things like this. So there, I haven't seen anything that plausible that we can get to like 100% wind, for instance, and wind and solar, given the battery technology, which is improving. And kind of we have to stay optimistic about that. I know some people bring up nuclear in Ireland. There's kind of technical arguments about how expensive nuclear is. Like right now, we can't build a wastewater plant, never mind a nuclear plant.
Yeah, but you can buy modular nuclear plants that are apparently very cost-effective. Oh, Sheen's coming out in a rash there.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Only in the practicalities.
Listen, there's one thing I wanted to touch on before we go to a break. Tabitha, there's an interesting piece in the at the bottom of the front page of the Sunday Times, asylum families rules set to be tightened.
Yeah, and it's kind of comes off the back of all we're hearing from the government in relation to developing a firm and fair asylum process. So we heard about the contribution fees there a number of weeks ago that went to a cabinet subcommittee where anybody who's in international protection accommodation will be expected to contribute a certain amount towards their accommodation. So this is just another kind of strand of this. And asylum families, the rules are set to be tightened if they want their families to come over to Ireland and then to be reunited with them. So one of the aspects of that is that if somebody who is in international protection, if they haven't paid that contribution fee, they won't be able to reunite with their families. Another aspect of that is that these people who are seeking to reunite with their families, they will have to prove that they have enough income and adequate housing to be able to house their families. So that's another aspect of it. And then they're also looking at the income threshold for reunification of families. So at the moment, the minimum is €30,000 a year. What could happen, and that hasn't set yet exactly how much it could go up by, but it could potentially go up by either €5,000 or €10,000 a year. So essentially just making sure that anybody who is coming over to Ireland, that they are able to essentially stand on their own 2 feet. But one of the things that was part of that article on the Sunday Times was that they don't expect any change to healthcare workers who are already treated differently.
Suzanne Rogers, from a social justice point of view, I'm suspecting there's not going to be a huge outcry over this. There are things now being brought in all the time that would have been probably unacceptable to people, certainly publicly, a few years ago. And now it just seems that we are, in pragmatic, granular terms, changing our immigration regime completely. And people are not going crazy or anything. They're quietly accepting it.
I think the asylum system makes up such a teeny, 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 tiny, I cannot stress how small the percentage is when we look at overall migration figures. So if we're not talking about anybody who has complete freedom of movement in Europe, anybody coming here with work visas or school visas, anybody coming in, you know, through that system. So, I mean, this, and it may be that is the problem, is because it actually impacts such a small, you know, a percentage of people who move to this country. So I don't know whether, like, it talks about asylum seekers, but I don't know whether the family reunification system, if they're just talking about asylum seekers or they talk, and again, I suppose, yeah, they've got the income thresholds for anybody here who's legally resident. So, I mean, when you look at, say, like the labour force survey from the CSO, it is, for want of a better word, it's non-Irish who are the high earners in this country. So I don't think that's going to be a problem for, like everything else, it always comes down to money, it comes down to your social class, it comes down to where you sit in the system. So for a lot of people, this really isn't going to make a big difference. Okay. Asylum seekers, you know, again, they're a very, very small proportion of it. So again, we'll wait and see how it plays out.
Okay, and there's talk as well, I think, of cutting the amount of international students who come to study and work, a lot of them in Ireland. Okay, Oisín Coughlan, Tabitha Monaghan, Suzanne Rogers and Sean O'Neill McPartlin staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Oisín Coughlan, Tabitha Monaghan, Suzanne Rogers and Sean O'Neill McPartlin still with us. So Lazy Gen Z would bite your hand off to work in the office, according to Julie Maloney in the Sunday Independent. Culture of laziness is real, and I know how we can change it, according to Owen O'Malley in the Sunday Independent. Tabitha Monaghan, you've picked both of those. Now, what gen are you?
I am a millennial.
Okay.
So I don't fit into either of these. But what I was reading, and it's obviously off the back of the comments that Dennis O'Brien made in relation to the decline in work ethic, the country is grinding to a halt, and that the Irish graduates are entitled. What Julia Maloney is saying in the Sunday Independent is that experts, workplace consultants, that it's a myth that Gen Zs don't want to go into the office, that actually they're the least likely to want to remote work, and that older generations are just struggling to understand Gen Zs. One of the things that jumped out at me in this piece, though, was the complaints from employers that Gen Z don't like making phone calls. Yeah. And it's something that I've heard in my own workplace, you know, interns that are coming in that are more reluctant. They prefer, you know, a text message or they prefer an email. But when I started, and I started as a radio researcher, I despised making phone calls. It was really intimidating for me. It was only second worst to going out and having to do a Vox Pop and asking people their opinions, which I hated.
Because you're on the phone in front of everyone else.
Exactly. People listening to you. And especially when you start out, because you feel like everybody's listening to you. You don't know whether or not you're doing it right. After a while, you just become totally desensitized to it. And nobody's really listening to you. However, I think it's great if Gen Z do want to go into the office. And it's something that I've said to a few people, that if you're going into the office and you're listening to your senior colleagues, having those phone calls, you are picking skills up. You're learning how to interact with people. If somebody's giving you the runaround, you can hear how other people who've been in the industry longer are able to handle it. So that was just one of the things that... That jumped out at me. But I hate remote working. I will always go into the office. I despise
really,
it.
Really, yeah.
I feel it is really isolating. I like if you know, even if a phone call for me goes wrong, I love to be able to turn to my colleague and go, God, that person was horrible. And then you have a quick conversation about it and off you go and you move on.
Yeah, you see, it's fine for a while, yeah. And then I'd say people get older and they're like, no, I just stay at home. Sean, you're a Gen Z.
I'm the resident Gen Z correspondent here today.
Okay. And congratulations on getting out of your lazy bed this morning. Into us.
I think, like, there's a few articles on this weekend. I think, you know, I can't really comment on how lazy people are. I know in universities, and I'm not sure, I know everyone bashes the generation that comes after them. But in university, I do see, like, there is a lot of, Owen O'Malley refers to this, and I think Dennis O'Brien did refer to it also, which is like the gaming of... There's a bunch of schemes put in place for good reason. You know, if
this is accommodations.
Yeah, accommodations. And there's lots of things that ought to be accommodated that I think everyone would agree. But in my time in university, there was a huge amount of gaming of it. All these kind of miraculous conditions kind of appearing out of nowhere. And that's kind of what people were incentivized to do. Nobody checks and, you know, and they don't check out of compassion. They don't want to pry into people's personal lives. But that has been gamed. I don't know how that's kind of manifested in the workplace. But I should say, like, the trend does seem to be, and I've read some survey data on this, that Gen Z people are more unhappy than the people that came before them, the millennials and so on, that they're more lonely, for instance. They are, in fact, more anxious and depressed. Okay. There's, like, interesting questions about why that's happening. But, like, one reason, I'll just kind of canvas and see what people think, is that it's much, much easier to be on your own now than it used to be. Before, if I wanted, you know, to meet a romantic partner, I'd have to get out of bed. I'd have to leave my house and I'd have to maybe go to a party like Gen Zers.
Take a risk.
I'd have to take a risk. I'd have to look someone in the face and try to convince them to, you know, like me. Yeah. But now you kind of can sit at home. You can look at your phone on Tinder or whatever it is. So you can get a lot of stimulation from your computer in a variety of ways. And you kind of, we've made it really easy to kind of stay on your own and kind of occupy yourself. And we've made it quite hard to go out. Gen Zers, for instance, go to fewer parties than previous generations by huge margins. They drink less, they do less drugs, they have less sex. You might think, you know, some of those things are bad, like drugs, for instance, but it kind of all points towards people in Gen Z are, like, more isolated than the people that came before them. So if they are bad at working, and I'm not saying they are, there's probably reasons like that.
Well, you know what? Their parents would say to them, get into the office and that'll knock all of that out of you, because you'll have to start learning how to get on with people. Suzanne Rogers, I won't ask what generation you are, but you would be happy never to go back into the office again.
I suppose I will self-declare as X and proud of it. And absolutely, you can prize, you know, my work laptop from my cold, dead hands. I'm never going back into an office. But I benefited hugely from decades of being in workspace. places with
You've
other people.
You've done your time.
I've done my time.
Yeah.
But I definitely think if I was in my 20s or 30s and I was starting out in a career, if I was going in somewhere, you would have to be in the office. As you said, you have to be listening to what other people are saying, going, oh, I like that line, I'm robbing that, I'm taking that. But I think to pick up on Sean's point, like
okay,
that goes
quickly,
the dereliction piece that we talked about earlier on when he's talking about, you know, people need to live in cities. They've torn down every single venue in Dublin and built a hotel in it. So where do you go?
Yeah, okay. I'll let you all go home and be alone with your thoughts now for a while. Oisín Coughlin, Tabitha Monaghan, Suzanne Rogers and Sean O'Neill McPartlin. That was a terrific hour. Thank you very much. And at 12 noon now, we'll go to the newsroom and Kate Egan.